Before you start, Mr. Burns, I want to make sure the courtroom's clear. I want to make sure the courtroom's settled, okay? Okay, Mr. Burns.
Good morning, Your Honors. It may please the court. I'm Thomas Burns, and I represent Mary Beth Lukey. In Lewis against Union City, this court sitting en banc held that an employee's prima facie case must identify comparators who are similarly situated in all material respects. But Lewis took care to note that in the real world and in real workplaces, doppelgangers are like unicorns. They don't exist.
Well, we have no authority to depart from what our en banc precedent said, right?
I'm not asking you to.
Okay, good. And so some of the, it would seem, possible comparators here are actuaries, and your client said actuaries have always been different. She's not an actuary, and they're on a different pay scale, right? So who do we have as a comparator who's similar in all material respects?
It's Orr, Kirpitt, and Semke. Two of them are actuaries, like you said, but I don't think that takes.
They're not similar in all material. An actuary is not similar in all material respects.
Our position is they are.
Your client testified they're not. Your client testified that they've always been on a different pay scale. That's a specialized education. And they, in the marketplace, command more money.
Right, but there's also a confession, as I view it, by Orr, who says to Lukey, these are your peers. And he's not saying, I'm distinguishing on the various pay scales. I'm saying, these are your peers, and your pay is out of line with your peers. So that's a confession, in my view, from MetLife saying, these are the people that are, you're similarly situated to in all material respects. There are other guideposts that you should look at. Those are the titles, the supervisors they were reporting to.
So what authority, what would be the basis for our holding that Orr's, what you're calling a confession, is an admission that binds MetLife, that for these purposes, that means these actuaries are comparators in all material respects?
Yes, I think that's one of the key facts.
What would establish that? What would establish that he had the authority to bind MetLife on that point?
That he was a supervisor to her, and he was speaking on behalf of the company.
They were peers does not mean that they are valid comparators in all material respects for these purposes, does it?
Correct. I'm not saying that establishes it completely. I'm saying you take all of these facts, the titles, the supervisors they were reporting to, the number of direct reports they were supervising, that they had the same basic duties, and then this, on top of it, this confession that, look, these are your peers and your pay is out of line with your peers. I think when you take all that stuff, you put it in a pot, then we have established I guess there's a little bit of a fight about this, but like it's supposed to be a light burden at that stage. So I think you throw those facts in, and we've established then that she has comparators. I think it's all three. Perhaps it's just one, but then we would only need one, and that would mean that we've established that prima facie case and can move on to the rest of the analysis.
If we disagree, if we look at this record and say, look, actuaries are not valid comparators, then where are you?
So then I would say that we have one comparator and we still survive under McDonnell Douglas.
And then Semke, is that who that is?
I believe that I got the names mixed up, but I believe it's Semke who's the third one who's not an actuary.
If he worked in the International Investments Group reported to a different senior vice president. He oversaw risks for the European, Middle East, and Africa regions. Your client could not describe any of the specifics of his job during her deposition. When asked what he did on a day-to-day basis, said, "I wouldn't know." He was not doing risk for her for the same regions, and that they had different jobs. Right? That's the one we're going to say would be material in all. It would be the same and similar
absolutely.
In all material respects.
Yes. Okay. And but let's say that you are skeptical about that. And
let's say that I am.
And then the analysis goes to the convincing mosaic test, which is what we established in Smith against Lockheed. Lockheed, whatever. The district court's order addresses that in only one sentence, and it's conclusory. So we don't need a comparator. We can still move forward if we can establish the discriminatory intent, and the district court never analyzed that. So that's...
Whether it did or not, this we're here de novo. We can look at the record ourselves. How does this record otherwise give rise to a reasonable inference of discrimination?
Answering that question, I think there are a couple of troubling facts that do not weigh in your client's favor. I'm particularly interested in the fact that it appears that she tried to resign, if not twice, at least once, and was convinced not to do so. And then there's an email exchange or communication with a coworker that also is not very supportive, perhaps, of your client's position. So in answering the chief's question, I'm particularly interested in those facts.
So there's actually three questions there, two that you asked Chief Judge Pryor. So
I fully endorse my colleague's questions.
Let me take
questions.
Them in order. So absolutely, de novo
take
review.
Take as much time as you need.
Awesome. De novo review, you can answer the question for yourself. I'd ask you not to do that because...
let's move on.
Okay. But then there's... What's the evidence of pretext here? What we have is the disparate pay that we've identified. We have the confession and what I call the confession. And I don't know where I put that in my notes, but then there are also some comments at various times that were harassing, and so she can...
Yeah, some of those comments were like from 2011 to... What much earlier period.
Correct.
Right?
But I think that gets...
have really, and the individuals who make the comments, it appeared to me, had no relation whatsoever to these pay differentials that you're complaining about years later.
Right. But that kind of sets the framework for where she starts and what her experience is at this company. And then she's getting later on, not just in addition to the disparate pay, there's the sexist division of labor, and I think that can be filtered into your analysis.
But those are comments between 2007, 2011. Things are much better, as far as I can tell from this record, from 2011 to 2015. And then you have this pay differential issue that's the real issue in this case. I just don't see how those ancient comments, ancient in a more, pedestrian manner, have anything to do with this.
It just sets the context for the story. What I was talking about more was the sexist division of labor, and I think the sexist division of labor, where she keeps getting told, be the secretary, be the scribe, change the fonts, change the colors, that could be also relevant to the disparate pay argument. So we've got the disparate pay, and in addition, you've got these tasks that are being assigned in a sexist manner, and that would go toward the disparate pay argument. In addition, there's a second theory about the... Well, actually,
some of these tasks were something that she did, like, twice a year, right?
Well, she said those were for the board meetings, I believe, but she also said it was constant and she was doing it for men who weren't in her.
She said she complained that it was in addition to her professional duties, but I don't see how it in any way harmed the prestige of her position. She consistently received annual raises, bonuses, and the highest available reviews, right?
Correct.
Is your point that, for example, if only the women in an organization were required every day to get coffee for all of the men, regardless of their other job duties, and if a man replaced the woman in the position and was not then required to get coffee, that would change the conditions of work in such a way as to be discriminatory?
Absolutely, and I think that's why the BNSF against White case is so important and why this court's prior panel precedents in Smith against Fletcher and Cox against American Cast.
Let's talk about these tasks. I mean, I would certainly understand it if it were getting everybody coffee. That's not what we had here, right?
She did order pizza for people where she was responsible for doing that, so similar.
That's a little different than serving coffee, wouldn't you agree?
Yes.
Hey, somebody get the pizza. Okay.
But she was saying I was singled out for that task.
But like the compiling the goal sheets, the town hall slides, that's once or twice a year, right?
For the town halls, yes. But she was talking about having to sit in on other men's meetings, and that this was constant, and that she was constantly complaining about it. She was supposed to be the one who took notes.
Yeah, but her complaint wasn't that, as I understand it from the record, when she's complaining about it at the time, it's not a complaint that these are, you're just giving this to me because I'm a woman. It's that this is extra work above and beyond my professional duty. My other duties, right?
Exactly, and she says it's unfair, and she says I'm the only one that's having to do
problem,
this.
The problem she's complaining about is she wouldn't be getting this extra work if she weren't a woman. And the tasks that she's claiming that she's getting are tasks that are traditionally perceived as women's work, right? That's what
exactly.
She's saying.
Exactly.
I will tell you what I think the problem is with that, at least some of that, is that she's also conceded that this was not work that could have been done by an administrative professional, that it needed to be done by someone who was in the meeting at her level. She's said that to a certain extent. She's also said, you know, that some of these other vice presidents could have done their own work in this respect. And so maybe that's different and separated from that. But she did concede that there were times, you know, when she was required to take the minutes or whatever that had to be done by someone in the meeting and had to be done by somebody who had an understanding of these matters, which wouldn't have been just purely administrative work.
I didn't read that concession as extensively as perhaps you are. Like she was saying, I was the junior person in the meeting. A lot of times I didn't have anything substantive to add. I was just called into the meeting to be the person to take notes. And in fact, I think it was Cox who says, you know, be the scribe, which was kind of offensive to her. And she didn't want to call him out for saying something so sexist in the meeting, but
well,
she was
there.
Well,
one of the things, though, is that I have a problem with is I know that she's now characterizing this as feminine-type responsibility, stereotypically, but that's not what the complaint was at the time. That's not something she was ever communicating. What she was saying was, this is in addition to my other work, and it's an unfair distribution, right? I'm giving more extra work, and it's not tied to sex.
I think it still falls within the statute because it's because of sex. She just doesn't say.
But that's not what she says.
I recognize that factual issue, but it's still, in my view, under the statute because of discrimination because of sex. So we've talked about the disparate pay and disparate sexist distribution of labor theories. I'm over my time, but I'd love to talk with you.
I would appreciate you responding to the other facts in the record that are not as favorable and how you suggest we balance that out.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a fact-intensive record, and there are some favorable facts, unfavorable facts, for sure. You mentioned some of them in the question that I didn't actually get back to answer about, well, what about her resignations and then coming back? What she says is, like, I resigned because I was so frustrated about the disparate pay, because of the sexist distribution of labor, and then my bosses talked a good game and brought me back. That also might relate to the retaliation claim, which we haven't talked about yet, but one reason why somebody might want to bring somebody back even though they've retaliated against them is precisely because they're afraid that there might be a retaliation claim brought against them, and this kind of muddies the water from an evidentiary perspective. So,
is she continuing to work there?
No.
Okay.
She's not. The record just indicates she resigned, which she characterizes as a constructive discharge, and then the record is silent about everything else.
Okay.
I'm here all week, so I can talk about this case forever.
Okay. You've saved 3 minutes. Let's hear from Mr. Parlow. Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Chris Parlow, and I'm here representing the defendant, appellee. I guess, Your Honor, a few points that you raised. Mr. Orr was not a supervisor of the plaintiff. Mr. Orr was not deposed. He did not put in a declaration. So I don't think there was any type of confession from Mr. Orr about any individual saying that these were comparators or suggesting that they should all be paid the same. Counsel mentioned...
Tell me the context. Did he testify that her pay was, out of whack with her peers?
Mr. Orr did not testify at all. He was not deposed.
Did someone testify that he said that?
Counsel may be referring to a Mr. Frank Cassandra, who was a prior manager, who said only that he thought it would be appropriate to raise her comp. He was her mentor. He was her friend. He remained her friend after she resigned. She kept in constant contact with him. He was the one who originally had her attend meetings. So do I think he believed that her pay should be raised because she was valuable to him? Of course.
Yeah, did he testify?
I don't remember, Your Honor. But one comment is the one comment I think counsel is referring to.
He was her supervisor, though, for a period.
Yes, Your Honor, for a period of time, and a mentor and a friend. And he was the one who had her attend meetings that no other vice president did. She went out of her way, as she testified, to help him. She enjoyed doing it. The testimony is that others knew that she enjoyed doing that. She volunteered for him to compile reports. This is not a case in which, counsel used the word. She was told, be the scribe, be the secretary. The words be the secretary are nowhere in the record. The words be the scribe is one sentence where it was describing what she was doing. Your Honors, there are many men and women in the back of this courtroom today who are taking notes. I think it's part of their job. I think both the men and the women would find that saying that was feminized work is antiquated
and
inappropriate.
There's only one person who takes notes for an entire meeting, and it's always the woman, and it's traditionally been viewed as a woman's job, then I think you would agree with me, maybe you wouldn't, and then if you wouldn't, I'd like to hear it, that would be discriminatory conduct.
Your Honor, I have a wife for 30 years, a sister, nieces I took to the Army-Navy game this weekend. If there was a policy or procedure that only the women should take the notes, that's discriminatory. There's a case in the record that would cross the line. That's just not what occurred here. Putting aside that this was
I understand. I just want to make sure we're talking about the same thing.
If I said anything otherwise, I'd be killed the minute I got home.
Your point was that it's not necessarily the case, though, that whenever someone is tasked with writing notes, that is necessarily gives rise to an inference of sexism.
Yes, Your Honor.
That was your only point.
First, she was not tasked with anything. There's nothing in the record that says this was her task. And to the contrary, this is something she did. Number two.
Well, she didn't do it voluntarily. She was asked to do it. I mean, some could call that a task.
Asked to be the person taking notes in a meeting with other senior vice presidents and business line leaders is a completely appropriate task. I do that when I'm the junior lawyer in a meeting.
It's not about you. It's not about the people in the back. It's about Ms. Lukey, who's arguing that she was assigned these tasks. What would have happened, perhaps, if she had said, no, I don't want to do this?
Your Honor, there's evidence in the record that the male supervisors themselves would have had to do it. Out of the four things that she is claiming were problematic to do, attending meetings with senior vice presidents, preparing reports that came out of those meetings, preparing other risk assessment materials, that would have fallen on the male individuals to do.
And so that means that there were male individuals in those settings who could have performed those tasks. Why was she the one repeatedly asked to do them?
Well, first of all, there's no evidence that she was repeatedly asked to do them. And those tasks were done by others, including males, after she left.
So let's make sure we understand this. So someone in the room was going to have to do it. And it would not have been an administrative assistant, male or female. It would have been someone in this management classification. Is that right?
To your point, Your Honor, this is not
yes or no.
Taking
the notes, preparing the product of the meetings, that would have had to have been done by one of the professionals in the room. Isn't that right? Isn't that what the record says?
For the quarterly.
It wouldn't have been any kind of administrative person, male or female, lower level administrative person, because those people aren't in the room, and it wouldn't have been able to do it. Isn't that right?
Yes. Okay. For the quarterly and annual meetings.
So what we're talking about is a task that would have had to have been done by a professional, and the fact that she was assigned it, whether it's occasionally or repeatedly, what she was being assigned, looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to her, is a professional responsibility. Is that your point?
Not just my point. It's what the district court found. The district court found that the meetings she was asked to attend, the things that she was asked to report on, were far from secretarial. They were not secretarial tasks. And if there were meetings other than those quarterly or annual meetings, there was a whole host of administrative assistants at her disposal that she could have used at any time to do those, whatever tasks she did not want to do. The fact that she may have chosen not to do that, whether it was a male or a female administrator, does not change the circumstance.
Wasn't she also complaining that the other vice presidents had to prepare reports and they were never done properly, and she was required to correct them and make them presentable, and she was being paid less than they were?
She was paid less than they were, Your Honor, because of their duties and responsibilities.
I understand. I'm just saying.
Yes. But I think Judge
Pryor... Is that a problem? Why isn't that a problem?
It's not a problem. Judge Pryor addressed this.
I understand, yeah. It's not a problem Judge Pryor asked you about. But why isn't that otherwise a problem?
Your Honor, it's not a when there is a complaint, that complaint does have to tie into, and this is a problem because of my gender. What she was saying, the only type of complaint she made, and I asked her over and over and over again, it's in the record, we put it in bold in the brief, did this have anything to do with the agenda? The answer was no. And the reason she had to answer that way is because Frank Cassandra was her mentor and friend. He's not named. She didn't want to point a finger at anyone. So what she said, to Judge Pryor's point, was some of these men were lazy. Some of these men were sloppy. I fixed the things that they did wrong. And I got credit for it, and I got to be put in other meetings.
I understand. Your point is she did all these things, but it wasn't related to her gender. That's what your point is.
Yes, and it's not all these
things. Nor did she tie it to her gender when she complained about it. Isn't that also the point?
Correct. And, you know, this goes to the point of whether there's retaliation in taking away the MIM work. Now, she can't have it both ways. She said she brought up these complaints about, hey, he's sloppy, hey, he didn't do the right font, I had to fix it, in 2014, 15, 16, 17. At no point in time did any individual retaliate against her for raising those issues. There would have been more if she had said that it was because of her gender, if she had gone to HR, if she had gone to legal, if she'd gone to the EEOC, but she didn't. She continued to do what she was doing. It's not plausible that Mr. Cox, after all of these years, decided now today is my evil scheme because she mentioned that these people were lazy or didn't do the best work they did on their papers. I'm going to take away the MIM work, and I'm going to do that to penalize her. That's just not a plausible argument. Your Honor, I want to quickly address the idea that there was a constructive discharge. That needs to be an objective standard. The MIM work that was removed from the plaintiff was a small part of, small might be an exaggeration. She, by her own testimony, was 10 to 20% of her work. She kept all of her other work. She kept all of her other duties and responsibilities. She kept getting fantastic raises. She kept getting fantastic reviews. The minute she asked for a transfer to Florida, it was granted. You have a group of individuals, not just one person, but Mr. Cassandra and Mr. Cox, who are going out of her way to make sure that she remained employed, that she remained highly compensated, that she remained motivated. Mr. Cox did so even after she showed up on a meeting drunk. He didn't take any action against her. That would have been the perfect opportunity for him to get rid of her. Spoke to Mr. Cassandra, and they worked to keep her there. He didn't do it when she didn't show up for other meetings because she was having some personal problems. Would have been another perfect opportunity to let her go. Judge Abudu, you mentioned that she had resigned. It actually occurred on two prior occasions, none of which had to do with anything at work. The record is replete with evidence that she was unfortunately having some significant personal issues. She was traumatized by her move that everyone helped her with. She was traumatized by being beaten up by her boyfriend. She was having alcohol issues. And again, it would have been the perfect opportunity if someone wanted to retaliate against her to say, no, that's not what they did. They went out of her way to keep her there. They marshaled the troops. They went and found her when she was missing for an entire weekend. Those are not the activities of a company or an individual who is looking to discriminate against someone. It's not. When you're looking for evidence of a nexus, The only nexus with respect to the transfer of the MIM work is her move. She alleges she complained about the administrative tasks for four straight years, and nothing was done negative to her. The MIM work wasn't moved. The only thing that changed in those 4 years was her saying, "I would like to move to Florida." Now, what did that trigger? The MIM work is MetLife Investment Management. I've been there. I know it's not about me, but I'm just telling you it's in New Jersey. That's where their headquarters are. That's where the business line leaders are. That's where the investment team is. That's where the individual who she says she was supervising, who did the MIM work, worked. It was a completely legitimate, non-discriminatory reason for Mr. Cox to believe that it was best to have an individual based there in New Jersey with the client, with the people doing the work. The only thing that changed was her request, which was immediately granted, to move to Florida, we thought, to get away from her abusive boyfriend. So if there's any inference...
I think there could be a lot of reasons to move from New Jersey to Florida.
No comment. So the only inference you can draw from the factual record is that when after she requested the move and became no longer in New Jersey, no longer there with her client. That's when the MIM work was changed. And by the way, there's much said about transferring this work to Mr. Orr, who the plaintiff appellant claims did not know how to do that work. Maybe that's the case. The record is clear that Mr. Cox wanted to bring Mr. Orr back. He worked at MetLife. They liked his work. They had to lure him back. If part of that was, I'm going to have you do this MIM work, that's not discriminatory. That wasn't done because of anyone's sex, Mr. Orr's or the plaintiff's. That was done because they wanted to bring someone back into the fold and they were throwing another carrot. This court has made very clear it doesn't second guess those things. It's very hard to allocate finances among individuals, and we don't second guess that.
Okay, Mr. Parlow, do you have anything else?
No, Your Honor. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Mr. Burns, you have 3 minutes.
Mr. Burns, I do want to follow up on one of the facts that I mentioned, in particular, the communication. She talks about how, she says, I ended up at MetLife in risk management. I hated my job and the stress, although I had good money. I called in one day to say, I'm not coming back. Where should I send my laptop? And then there's also other discussions which are not related to the sex discrimination claims that are being argued here. So I do feel like, especially to the extent that the issue of a convincing mosaic is still at issue here, how does this not defeat Ms. Lukey's claims?
I don't think it defeats it. It creates a dispute of fact, or it creates an evidentiary problem for Ms. Lukey. So their story is, you resigned for totally different reasons. But she also has testimony in her deposition saying, the reason I was resigning was because of my frustrations with the Sexist Division of Labor and the disparate pay. I think she gets asked about that at deposition, and she says, oh, that was like a thing that I sent to a friend, and she was maybe not as careful with like a preposition she used. This is my reading of it, like a preposition she used in the text message. So I think it creates potentially a trial problem for her, but it shouldn't create a summary judgment problem for her. I'd like to talk about the note-taking, and I'd like to split it into the legal part and the factual piece. So the legal position that MetLife had taken in its brief was that the employers can actually single out women to perform feminized tasks, like the note-taking. I don't think that could possibly be correct, because it doesn't matter if that their title's not changed or their pay's not changed. It's stigmatizing, and it creates a dignitary harm. If you look, there's a...
My understanding of what your adversary said was that this was professional-level work that someone in the room was going to have to do, and it had appeared to me from the record that your client thought so, too. What about that?
That's the factual piece, which I was going to get to. I'm not reading the record the same way it sounds like you are. I think she was saying...
Was there a secretary in the room that could have done it? Male or female?
She said that there were available secretaries. She didn't say that they
were
in
the
room.
Were they in the room?
She didn't say they were in the room.
Any evidence that they would have ever been capable of doing it?
She said that the note-taking didn't require substantive knowledge, so they could have been in the room. I think she asked that somebody else do it, and that's why she...
Someone else, though, could be someone else in the room, right?
That could be true. But I think what she suggests is it should have been done by a secretary. That would have made the most sense, and she's not a secretary. So if you don't adopt the legal position that you can single out women to note-taking, that have staggering implications. I think that's a very bad idea.
I didn't understand that to be argued here.
Okay, good. At least we're on the same page. Convincing mosaic. Sorry. One of the things I would like to talk to you about is this recent decision in Tynes against Florida Department of Juvenile Justice, and it talks about the role of McDonnell Douglas at the summary judgment stage. I think probably you're all familiar with it because the slip opinion would have come out. Really, we're talking about not, like, the failure to make the prima facie case should just drop, even if that happens, should just drop out of the case, and we just go to the convincing mosaic standard, and that's exactly the analysis that the district court didn't do. And that's why we think...
Whether it did it or not, we can do it.
And that's totally 100% correct. It's just there. I think the district courts... There are a lot of cases saying that the district court should do that in the first instance for institutional reasons, efficiency reasons.
A lot of district courts have been confused about this, Mr. Burns. I think some of our recent precedents have been clarifying on that point. But on de novo review of a summary judgment, we have the record before us. We can look at it.
True.
And you have the obligation to explain to us why there's a convincing mosaic of circumstantial evidence that would support the claim.
Well, you're telling me that now, not as a SEPUPO.
That would have been true regardless. You're saying you were confused about it too? I mean,
no,
my understanding is it's one thing for district courts to be confused about it. My understanding is you've recognized their confusion. You're arguing that they've been confused about it, but you can't just rest on that. You've got to explain why it makes a difference. You explain that it makes a difference is by saying how there's a convincing mosaic of circumstantial evidence that would support the claim.
So as a matter of SEPUPO versus Allstate Insurance Company, this wasn't a ground of the district court's order. I didn't say that this was a ground of the district court's order, so I was asking you to remand that to be considered. You're telling me now at oral argument, which is totally fair.
We can affirm for any reason supported by the record.
No dispute. I agree with that. So what we're saying is that there are disputes of fact about shown by her the evidence she brought forth on her prima facie case. There are some complexities and uncomfortable facts that she has to deal with. Those really should be resolved by a jury. I'd like to address discharge.
Unless there are any more questions, we've allowed you to go over both times.
I know, and I don't want you to gavel your hand like yesterday.
Okay, Mr. Burns. I think we have your case. Thank you very much. We'll go to the last case, Killo versus All Points Logistics.